Okay, anyway, Parshas Bar opens up with Aver Hashem El Moshe Behar Sinai Le'emor. Kadosh Baruch Hu speaks to Moshe on Har Sinai. And at Har Sinai, does anyone mind if I open some windows? Okay, God speaks to Moshe at Har Sinai, and what does he tell him? The Bar of Nesel, the Maitalem, Kitavov, Elohim, the Sharanin, the Zenli, the Nechem, Beshavta, Aretz, Shabbat, Hashem. God spoke to Moshe at Har Sinai, and he says to him, which mitzvah? The mitzvah of Shemitah. Sheshanim, Tizrat, Sabecha, Beshashanim, Tizmok, Amecha. 6 years you should work the land. On the seventh year you should leave its fallow. So, Rashi already points out, quoting from the Medrash, Ma'inyan Shemitah etzel Sinai. Why is it that the mitzvah that is singled out to be the mitzvah of Har Sinai is the mitzvah of Shemitah? Okay? Is there some sort of special relationship between Shemitah and Har Sinai? Alright? Okay, so here we go. A few answers dealing with this question. That's the bottom line question. That's the question we'll give three Tevei Torah on this question. Why is it that more than any other mitzvah, we are identifying Shemitah with Har Sinai? Okay. Okay. The Ksav Sofer says the following. The Ksav Sofer says that what is the idea behind Shemitah? What happens on the Shemitah year is that we have, it's a great socialist creed, if you will. We have social classes that develop over the course of 6 years. One person's field is able to produce a lot. Another person's field is not able to produce, or one person might not have a field. And what happens in Shemitah? Shemitah is an equalizer. Suddenly everyone is equal. I am no longer allowed to work my field. And in fact, all of the fruits of that field are now hefker. Anyone who desires to come and take that food and fruit is able to. He's allowed to. It's a great equalizer. It's actually quite a nice idea. It's a balance between the capital system and the socialist need for equality. And that is expressed in Shemitah. All people are equal. That is a necessary precursor for Har Sinai as well. At Har Sinai we were given 613 mitzvahs. But the burden of 613 mitzvahs cannot possibly be performed by one person alone. It is impossible just from a physical standpoint, because if you're a man, you cannot be mekayem those mitzvahs that are for a woman. If you're an Israel, you cannot be mekayem those mitzvahs that are for a Kohen, whatever. It is impossible for all of us for any individual to be mekayim the Torah on his own. In order for the Torah to be mekayim b'shleimus, there has to be a sense of unity and coming together of Klal Yisrael. Shemitah represents that unity, and that unity is a precursor also for Har Sinai. We've spoken about it at the time in Parashas Yisro, Vayichan Sham Yisrael Neged Ahar, that Klal Yisrael was encamped by the mountain, but it doesn't say Vayachanu, they part, it said he part, singular. And again, we stressed over there, Ke'ish Echad B'Lev Echad, they were like one entity. In order to receive the Torah, there has to be a feeling of camaraderie, there has to be a sense of responsibility one to the other, there has to be a sense of equality and recognition that I on my own cannot handle the Torah. Shemitah and Har Sinai are inextricably linked. Okay, that's approach number one from the Ksav Sofer. Okay. Second approach was brought down in the Sefer Ma'ayana Shel Torah. Ma'ayana Shel Torah is a compilation of ideas from different people, and I don't remember who he quoted for this idea. But it's in the Sefer Ma'ayana Shel Torah. I think they translated it to English. It was originally written in Yiddish. And then they translated it to Hebrew, Ma'ayana Shel Torah. And in English, I think it's called Wellsprings of Torah. Would make sense. Is there a book? Does that sound familiar? Wellsprings of Torah? Anyway, they're Kval Torah in Yiddish, if anyone's a Yiddish speaker. Okay. So, in it, he says the following. Oftentimes, people, philosophers, whatever it may be, find it difficult to believe that God concerns Himself, God who is entirely spiritual, would concern Himself with the spiritual world. Why should God sully Himself, dirty Himself, if you will, to trouble with the little things? Right. Shemitah comes along and shows us that God does in fact concern Himself with even our physical well-being. God gives us a promise, you do Shemitah, fear not, I will make sure to provide food for you. Shemitah proves that God is not exalted and aloof, meaning He is exalted, but He's not aloof and detached. He's not divorced from the world, He engages in the world. Har Sinai as well is a similar idea. We know, of course, I think we know, there's a Midrash that says that all the mountains were fighting, where will the Torah be given? And God chose Har Sinai. Why did God choose Har Sinai? Because it was the lowest of the mountain. And it's exactly the same idea. God is not looking to detach Himself. God is looking to, in fact, be involved and lower Himself to help out the downtrodden, the despondent, in all elements of society, to involve Himself with this world. There is a... I might have mentioned this to you guys once. When I was in high school, I went to Ramaz. And at the time that I was there, the Ramaz girls basketball team was in the midst of a tremendous run. They were undefeated for 3 years. And they were now in their fourth year, going for an undefeated fourth season and championship. I believe those were the statistics. So they managed to put the string together an undefeated season. And they were all the way through into the playoffs. And before Mincha one day, Rabbi Luxtein, the principal, got on the loudspeaker. We davened Mincha in classrooms. We didn't get together for Mincha at that time. I think that subsequent to that, we switched it to davening altogether. But at that time, I was a freshman and a sophomore, we were davening in classrooms. And Rabbi Luxtein got on the loudspeaker and he said, please, in your Shema Koleinu, feel free to insert a prayer for the girls' basketball team today to succeed in their championship run. So I remember thinking, first of all, who's davening? Second of all, that was a joke. Second of all, I was like, really? That's what I should be davening for in the girls' basketball team to win? All right. I don't remember whether I did or did not. Right. However, clearly it made a point, because I think about it over and over and over again throughout the day. This is 20 years ago, and I'm still thinking about it. And the more I thought about it, the more I began to realize, you know, Rabbi Luxtein might have a point in there. Why is it that I should feel ashamed to ask God even for that? It's as if I'm saying that God doesn't belong in every part of my... Of course God belongs in every part of my life. You just have to turn on that, I think. Oh, no, it seems to be on. Maybe it's on. What? Right? Of course, to not ask God for help in your basketball game would say that God is limited. He's not able to enter into every element of our life. So the more I thought about it, the better it is. Okay. This is also parallel to a Torah from Rav Nachman Mbreslev, in terms of God is even in the lowest places where you don't think He might be. But we won't elaborate on that. So that's the second inyan of Shemitah at El Har Sinai. Shemitah shows that God is concerned with even the mundane and trivial things like parnasa and making sure that everyone has what to eat, the physical. And as well, Har Sinai, the smallest of the mountains, shows that God lowers Himself, etc. Okay. Lastly, the last idea of Shemitah Etzel Sinai is the following. God, question is, I will skip it for now. Okay, we're going to skip that one for now. Okay, Vaida, let's go on a little bit more. One more explanation of... We'll do a third explanation, but not that one. We're going to go for four. Let's do one more... stopping with Inyan Shemitah Tzel Har Sinai. Okay, the Torah tells us that if we do not stick to keeping Shemitah and Yovel, so there's going to be a price to pay. What's the price to pay if we do not adhere to Shemitah and Yovel? So HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells us in the Tochacha, not in this week's Parsha, but in next week's Parsha, in the Chukosai, HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells us, V'hashimoti es, V'hashimoti ani es ha'aretz, V'shamamu alei avachem ha'yoshvim etchem, right? I will make your land desolate, I will kick you out of the land, as titzei ha'aretz et shapsusei ha'kol yimei ha'shaba. And then the land will be able to be paid for her Shemitahs, all the Shemitah that it missed. If the Kadosh Baruch Hu kicks all the Jews out of Eretz Yisrael, and there's nobody to work the land, then the land will have the Shemitah that is owed to the land. So people ask, why is it that, in the Sefer Motzah Shalal Rav, why is it that the appropriate punishment for not keeping Shemitah is galus, and being kicked out of the land? So Rabbi Yaakov Chai Zarayan, who's not based in Tveria, and is quoted in the Sefer Motzeh Shalal Rav, says the following. He says, what is Shemitah? Shemitah is proof that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has Hashkacha on this world. Right? For 6 years you work the land, which, naturally speaking, should weaken the land. By the time you've planted the land six times over, and cropped, is that a word? You've cropped it six times. Harvested, thank you. Without your headband, then you're still able to pull that in. Okay, you've harvested the land six times. The land should, in theory, become weaker. And yet, the promise over here is that at the sixth year, you will have a crop that is even stronger than you've had 5 years ago. It will be enough to last you, not just this year, but even the following year. It is not b'derech hateva. Shemitah is the ultimate proof of Kadosh Baruch Hu's Hashkacha. And sometimes when you have a Shemitah and Yovel, then the crop of the sixth year, right, which has to last you for the next year, which is Shemitah, and the year after that, which is Yovel, it's supposed to last you for 2 years. 2 years worth of grain, that is an amazing thing, and that only happens with Hashkacha of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What another type of Hashkacha of HaKadosh Baruch Hu? The Jewish people, the fact that we are still around, is proof of Hashkacha of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Naturally speaking, we should no longer be here. There have been great empires before that have come and gone. The Romans, the Turks, the Greeks, the Macedonians. Empire after empire. All you need to do is breeze through the Encyclopedia Britannica to know that people have come and gone. And yet amazingly, the Jew, who is a small nation, Paul Johnson, who's a non-Jewish historian, but a brilliant historian, and I don't just say that because he writes a nice history of the Jews, but in his introduction to his book, History of the Jews, makes this point. He says that one of the reasons why he chose to write the history of the Jews is because he's just fascinated by it. He's like, how can it be that the people are still around, the stubborn, persistent, still here after all those years? He says, according to the Chukei HaTeva, it cannot be that we should still be around. So comes along Rabbi Yaakov and he says the following. He says, if you negate the belief in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Hashkacha by not adhering to Shemitah, then HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to say, fine, you don't want to live by the laws of Hashkacha, you don't want to have Bitachon in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, fine. So let's see what happens without Hashkacha. And without Hashkacha, then we go back to Chukei HaTeva. And according to Chukei HaTeva, naturally, we should no longer be on our land. It is impossible for the Jewish people to survive so long, and then again, after 2,000 years, to be back here. It's an unbelievable. It can only happen through Hashkacha of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So, Shemitah is Hashkacha, the Jewish people is Hashkacha. And therefore, if we are not going to keep to Shemitah, if we're going to say we don't trust the Kadosh Baruch Hu, but then the Kadosh Baruch Hu is going to say, fine, I will remove my Hashkacha, and you will see what happens without Hashkacha, you will no longer be in your land. In terms of the Jews' ability to survive and thrive, right? I quoted to you before from Paul Johnson, I didn't quote to you, I told you. I will quote you now one more. Mark Twain, I assume people are familiar with this paragraph, correct? Okay, Mark Twain on the Jews. If the statistics are right, the Jews constitute but 0.25% of the human race. I think it's even less than that. It suggests a nebulous puff of stardust lost in the blaze of the Milky Way. Properly, the Jew ought hardly to be heard of. but he is heard of, has always been heard of. He is as prominent on the planet as any other people, and his importance is extravagantly out of proportion to the smallness of his bulk. His contribution to the world's list of great names in literature, science, art, music, finance, medicine, and abstruse learning are also very out of proportion to the weakness of his numbers. He has made a marvelous fight in this world in all ages, and has done it with his hands tied behind him. He could be vain of himself and be excused for it. The Egyptians, the Babylonians, and the Persians rose to fill the planet with sound and splendor, then faded to dream stuff and passed away. The Greeks and the Romans followed and made a vast noise, and they were gone. Other people have sprung up and held their torch high for a time, but it burnt out, and they sit in twilight now and have vanished. The Jew saw them all, survived them all, and is now what he always was, exhibiting no decadence, no infirmities of age, no weakening of his parts, no slowing of his energies, no dulling of his alert but aggressive mind. All things are mortal but the Jews. All other forces pass, but he remains. What is the secret of his immortality? Mark Twain, September 1897. Again, this is the notion of Hashgacha v'Kadosh Baruch Hu. Sometimes it's Jews, it's hard for us to see. We need an outsider to tell it to us. But here you have it. We don't keep the Shemitah, we decide to take ourselves out of belief in Hashgacha, then HaKadosh Baruch Hu will take away this Hashgacha, which was so plain to the eye, even for Mark Twain to notice. Okay. Weiter. Okay, here is a thought-provoking question for you. You can raise it at whatever Shabbos you may find yourself in this Shabbos. One of the laws that's brought down in this week's parsha is, of course, the law of ribis. Ribis means interest. You're not allowed to charge interest to a fellow Jew. Now, if you think about it, this law is somewhat hard to comprehend. Why is this law somewhat comprehend? Let's say, in my backyard, I have 20 lawnmowers. Right. I have some sort of fetish. I am obsessed with lawnmowers. And then, my neighbor comes to me and he says, you know, my grass is really growing. Can I borrow a lawnmower from you? And I say, yeah, you can borrow the lawnmower, but you know what? I'm going to charge you $10 for every day that you have that lawnmower. Am I allowed to do that? Of course. Nobody would accuse me of anything, save for being a bright industrialist who was able to predict the pattern of grass growing and filling a need. Right. Very good. Now replace the 20 lawnmowers with 20 stacks of $100 bills. I have 20 stacks of $100 bills. Comes my neighbor and he says, listen, I need a stack of $100 bills. No problem, I can give it to you. Listen, just do me a favor, for every day that you have it, I'll take $10. Is that allowed? No, that's ribis. So you have to wonder, what is the difference between the stack of $20 bills as opposed to the 20 lawnmowers? What is the difference? Okay? Something to think about. Right. So, one possible answer is the fact that more than any other item, when a person is strapped for cash, he is more desperate than any other. Right? If he needs a car, okay, no. If he needs, generally speaking, when a person is strapped for cash, it's reflective of a real desperate need. When a person is in the desperate need, for me to then see that as an opportunity, as a financial opportunity, that's a little bit corrupt. Right? When a person comes to you in desperate need and all you can see is, you know, like those dollar signs flashing in your eyeballs, all you can see is an opportunity for profit, that's a little bit problematic. And that is why, in that sense, the Torah tells you, resist the urge. Right? Other things, right? Car, lawnmower, whatever it may be, people can do. But generally, cash, money, right? The reason why a person needs money more often than not is for his basic needs, for the food and for his necessities, and therefore we do not charge ribis on that. We do not want to turn another man's plight into a profit-gaining opportunity for you. Okay, again, it's a difficult thing because I can find other examples where the person is desperate, where we are still allowed to take ribis, or I can come up with examples where a person is filthy rich and we're still not allowed to take ribis. Difficult, but definitely something that worth thinking about and raising. Okay. After we have Shemitah, so what comes after Shemitah? After seven cycles of Shemitah, we have Yovel. And it says the following, on the Yovel, you blow the shofar, right? On Yom Kippur of Yovel, and then what happens? And you proclaim liberty throughout the land unto all the inhabitants. Where is that from, by the way? I mean, it's from the Torah, but where else is it? What? Yeah. Liberty bell, correct. Most people go and they look at the crack, and they... the crack on the belt. They don't look at the pasuk, but it's proclaim liberty throughout the land unto all the inhabitants thereof. Proclaim liberty. So there is a slight problem with this pasuk. What's the slight problem in this pasuk? Who's going free? What? Is it true? Inhabitants? All the inhabitants are going free? No. Who's going free? The slaves are going free, right? If I own the slave and now I'm setting him free, so my slave is going free. It's not all the inhabitants go free, it's just the slave. So why is it that the pasuk says again, it's pasuk Yud, Ukratem Drobat Lechol Yoshvea, proclaim liberty throughout the land unto all the inhabitants. Oh. So many of the Baalei Musar explain the following idea. They say that a person has to recognize that owning a slave can sometimes come with, not sometimes, is often also attached with certain obligations that you have. For example, the Gemara teaches us that if, let's say, a slave has only, a master has only one pillow. So who's going to get that pillow? You or your slave? We in our modern day corruption think that of course I'm going to get it. I'm the master, I deserve it. But the Torah tells us no. You know who's going to get that pillow? Your slave is going to get that pillow. He has to be imach. You have to provide for him the same way you provide for yourself. You cannot have to, right? Or there are certain, owning a slave is not without responsibility. You have no right to just, you know, pretend like you're living in Uncle Tom's cabin, beat him, and hang him up in the rack and just take out all of the aggravations on him, frustrations, and constantly mistreat him. That's not what a Jewish slave is about. In fact, you have very, very strong obligations towards him. And therefore, when the slave is released, says the Torah, it is a freedom, proclaim liberty unto all the inhabitants. Because the masters as well, the people that own the slaves, were also enslaved to the slave. Counterintuitive, but in fact correct. Right, there's a beautiful story, you might have heard it, by Rav Zalman Meltzer. Rav Zalman Meltzer, have you ever had a tour with your Benji Levine of Yerushalayim? Anyone ever? Was lucky enough, fortunate enough to do a tour? Yeah? So, one of the places where he takes you, when he goes through the back alleys of Nachlaot, where, you know, which is where his grandfather, Ari Levine, lived, and where many, many of the Gedolim of the previous generations lived. So one of the places that he takes you is the house, the home of Rav Zalman Meltzer, who was a great Gedol. Rav Zalman Meltzer one day was walking home in the winter from his yeshiva, from the Slutsk yeshiva, and as he climbed the stairs up to his house, so he stopped. And he told his nephew, who was walking along with him, you know what, let's wait out here for a little bit. So, nephew's like, okay. But it was getting cold. And they waited 5 minutes and then continued. And then finally, after about 45 minutes, the nephew said again to his uncle, Uncle Rebbe, why are we out here? Just a little bit longer. And then an hour passed. And after the hour passed, he says, Uncle, why are we still out here? It's cold, you're old, we should get inside. He said, really, just another 5 minutes. 5 minutes later, they climbed up the stairs, and as they were climbing up the stairs, Rav Zalman Meltzer's lady that helps clean the house walked out. He said, "Thank you very much for all your help." He paid her, and then they went inside. So he said to him, "Why couldn't we go inside? There's no problem with Yichud." He said, "No, there was no problem with Yichud for us to go inside. However," he said, "as I walked up the stairs, I heard that she was singing. And I knew that if we walked inside, she would stop singing. She would feel uncomfortable and inhibited if we would be in there. And I did not want her to not be able to do her work fully in the way that makes her more inclined to work, in the way that makes her happy. I knew that singing was something that she enjoys doing. I don't want to impinge on that in any way." Again, that is that sensitivity that you're supposed to have to your workers. You're not just a master, a boss, right, who is coming down from above. There has a responsibility. You have certain obligations, and therefore the yovel is freedom for all. Okay. While we're speaking about the pillow that you have to give to your slave, I'll tell you guys a story. One more story. It was in 1945-46, at the end of World War II, and a few of the survivors were meant to make their way to Eretz Yisrael, and they were going to go to Bnei Brak. But the problem was, Rav Kahaneman, who was in Bnei Brak, did not have enough bedding for all of them. He just couldn't provide, and he was nervous. So he hung up signs. He had his bakrim hang up signs throughout the neighborhood. On Shabbos, I am going to Darshan. I would like everyone there. And everyone came into the drasha, and he spoke about this obligation that a master has to his slave. Right? The master, as we said, is responsible to, if he has just one pillow, to give it to the slave. And he asked, "How can it be that if I have just one pillow, I'm responsible to give it to the slave? What about the fact that it says, Chayecha Kodmim? Right? If let's say you have just one bottle of water, and it's not enough for two of you, who's going to drink it? Whose bottle is it to drink? It's your own bottle. Your life comes first. So I understand that it says Tovlo Imach, he's supposed to be good to him, etc. But if it comes down to the last pillow, should I get it first? V'chayachicha Imach?" So says Rav Kahaneman, the Chiddush of Kahaneman, says the Torah says, of course it's good for you. But what? The Torah assumed that if you had just one pillow and you were sleeping on it, you wouldn't be able to sleep well, knowing that somebody else is lacking a pillow. And because the Torah did not want you to have, you know, like sometimes you think, like, I'm going to, like, sometimes you go to sleep the night before a test and you can't sleep well because you're nervous. Well, what about the test? Or sometimes, you know, you have to wake up in an hour and a half, so you never get into a good sleep because you're so distracted. But it's the same thing over here. If we would have given you the pillow, you would have never had a good sleep, because the whole time you would have been tossing and turning. Oh, I have the pillow, but it's not fair. He doesn't have enough. Ironically, if you give away the pillow, you'll actually have a more comfortable sleep. If you're programmed correctly, you'll have a more comfortable sleep. So, says Rav Kahaneman, "I now have however number of hundreds of survivors that are coming from Europe, and they do not have any bedding. They have nowhere to sleep. And I know that if they have nowhere to sleep, none of us will be able to sleep as well. So please open up your hearts and make sure to provide for them." And sure enough, once the Shabbos, the entire cost of all the bedding, pillows, and sheets were covered. And just a nice idea from those words in this parsha of Tov Lo Imach, that you're supposed to provide for him, and how to balance that with providing for yourself. You will not be comfortable providing for yourself. You should not be comfortable providing for yourself before you provide for him. Okay. At the Jubilee, there's the Tkiyas Shofar. Before you release the slaves, V'avata Shofar Tra B'chodesh HaShvi'i, let the shofar blow, and then release the slaves. So the Chinuch, the Sefer HaChinuch, asks, what's the point of the Tkiyas Shofar on Yovel? And Sefer HaChinuch says, here we're going the opposite way, he says, look, the bottom line is, with all the obligations, it's good to own slaves. Financially, worthwhile. The overhead is relatively low. There's no social security, no pension, no anything. It's a pretty good proposition. Right? Financially, it's enticing to own slaves. And it's going to be difficult for you when the time comes to let go of your slave. And therefore, says the Sefer HaChinuch, we blow the shofar. And what does the shofar do? The shofar sounds throughout the land and it tells me everybody is doing this. And when I know that everybody is doing this, it helps me. It helps me to know that other people are going, you know, other people have the same ordeal as me, other people have the same enticing desire to keep the slave, and yet they're doing it, they're releasing the slaves. And when I know that we're all in this together, it is much easier for me. Right? It's a peer pressure. We have to not kid ourselves. Peer pressure is something that is applicable to a kid in fourth grade. It is applicable to a teenager at Yeshivat Leva Torah. And it is applicable to our parents in their whatever society and jobs they live in. Right? Keeping up with the Joneses, with the Cohens. It's always, we always look what the other person has as well. And there is a peer pressure. There's something called negative peer pressure and there's something called positive peer pressure. The Tkiyah Shofar and knowing that everyone else is going to be doing it is positive peer pressure, right? That's why why is it that shuls don't just send out a mailing for their raising funds or the Israel bonds? They don't just, why is it that they do it in shuls in public? Because they know that they're going to be able to generate pressure. Because if I see Mr. Schwartz donating $200 a month, you know, I don't want anyone to think that I don't. All right, so you know what? I'll give $200 as well, and then I'll give $1,000. It's positive peer pressure. Peer pressure has negative connotations, but not all peer pressure is bad. There is an idea of positive peer pressure as well. That is why we do it all together. That is why the shofar sounds. Right? However, the shofar that sounds is not just a regular tkiyah. It's like we blow it on Rosh Hashanah. Tkiyah, Truah, Tkiyah, to remind us of Akedas Yitzchak. Why do we need a reminder of Akedas Yitzchak? We need a reminder of Akedas Yitzchak because we need to know we have to sacrifice. Yitzchak Avinu was the ultimate symbol of sacrifice. Avram and Yitzchak are the ultimate symbols of sacrifice. And we too have to know. I know it is hard. The slaves are enticing, as we said before. But you know what? Sometimes sacrifices have to be made. And that is what the Torah recognizes by blowing the shofar, help you with the peer pressure, and also telling you, I understand it's difficult, but sacrifices have to be made. Okay. We will stop. All right. One more quick word from Jusha, just because some people went to Poland, and we didn't actually end up making it to Jusha's kever, but, yeah. In Parakafe, Pasuk Hafalef. The Torah says the following. Pasuk Chaf and Kapalav. Right, it's talking about Yovel, and then the Pasuk says the following. In Pasuk Chaf. And if you shall say, what shall we eat in the seventh year? Behold, we may not sow, not gather. Then Pasuk Kapalav. Then I will command my blessing upon you in the sixth year, and it shall bring forth produce for the 3 years. Right, then I will give a blessing. Then in the 6 years you should have enough to last you for Shemitah, and the year after that which is Yovel. So Rav Zusha asked, this is very uncharacteristic of the Torah. The Torah should have just said, V'tzivisis berkati lachem b'shana ha-shishi. The Torah should have just said, I will command my blessing upon you in the 6th year. Why did the Torah have to go out of its way to say, and if you shall say, what shall we eat in the 7th year, then I shall bless the produce. It should have just said, I will bless the produce. What's this? And if you shall say, what shall we eat in the 7th year? What's that all about? That is the question that Rav Zusha asked. So Rav Zusha said the following, relating to a point of Bitachon. Rav Zusha says that so long as you have Bitachon in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then HaKadosh Baruch Hu will continue to bless you and bless you and bless you. However, the minute you stop with your bidachon and you ask yourself, wait a minute, what am I going to eat? The minute you lose that element of trust in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, says Rav Jusha, then the Shefa, the bountiful mercy of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, His constant provision is going to stop. And because it's going to stop, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will then have to once again, right, He will have to, then I will commend my blessing, then I will have to command again my blessing. It's true. Had we never asked, it would have just been a natural blessing. But because we asked, it stops, and then God has to start the cycle again. This was Rav Tzisha Lishitaso, to have constant, tremendous amount of emunah and bitachon in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that He is always going to provide. Okay, we'll stop here. Everyone have a wonderful Shabbat.